From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm Kyle Crawford.
This week on War News Radio, talking peace, we hear about Afghanistan's peace jirga.
Next, we find out about how soldiers pass the time in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Then, we learn about civilian trials for Guantanamo Bay detainees.
Finally, we hear from the Afghan owner of a restaurant in Swarthmore.
This is War News Radio. The Afghan government has made gestures in the name of progress, such as the recent peace jirga, but they have been criticized as shallow and ineffectual. The idea of a full-fledged peace movement in Afghanistan might seem far-fetched, but an organized effort by the Afghan people may be what's really needed. Karim Saryahmed reports on the initial sparks of an Afghan peace movement, and this piece first aired in July.
Afghanistan's National Consultative Peace Jirga convened on June 2nd, just before the war in Afghanistan surpassed Vietnam as the longest war in the history of the United States. President Hamid Karzai called upon the Taliban to join in peace efforts and reintegrate themselves into society, addressing them as brothers. The Taliban would only comply if international forces in Afghanistan withdrew, and representatives from the Taliban were not even invited to the peace jirga. Israr Ahmed Karimzai, president of Awakened Youth Association, a network of Afghan youth organizations, had high hopes for the peace jirga and believes that it was productive. However, he finds the demands of both sides unreasonable.
The Taliban asked for the withdrawal of international troops, and the government asked them to lay down their weapons. These requirements are very extreme. To ask international troops to withdraw would be like destroying Afghanistan. On the other hand, you can't ask your armed opposition, who has more control over the country than you have. They will say, "Why shall we put down our weapons?" You need to sit down to negotiate on things.
Wajma Fo, the Afghanistan country director for the NGO Global Rights and a recipient of the International Women of Courage Award, thought President Karzai's refusal to even discuss the demands of the Taliban was a mistake. She saw the jirga as flawed on some very basic levels. She says the whole process was one-sided, and that President Karzai essentially told the jirga what conclusions to come to. Ms. Fo also considers it a contradiction to have counterinsurgency and reintegration at the same time.
How can you reintegrate people who are you killing in the counterinsurgency operations? And I think it was a very dangerous idea. I don't know who presented this to the Afghan government or to the international communities, that you can talk at the same time and you can kill at the same time.
Afghans, who have suffered for decades, are frustrated with their government. And young people who run out of options often join the insurgency. The government is aware of this issue, but the problem, according to Ms. Fo, is that the government does not take responsibility for its own people because it is corrupt and impotent.
There are many people who are angry because of the government of Afghanistan, me included. But I didn't pick up arms or I didn't pick up guns and I didn't explode myself. And we have nonviolent ways of resisting.
Recently, in the northern province of Faryab, militants burned down an entire village and just left.
So the people had demonstration, they asked the parliamentarians that we have been the people who tolerated even the failure of the government. We have been the people who have tolerated even the injustices of the government, but still we are being ignored and we are being deprived.
Ms. Fo has talked to many youth groups in northern and central Afghanistan who feel ignored and that they lack even international support. Anayat Safi, who has worked through the UN with youth organizations for the past 6 years, has been working to establish representative youth councils. Safi puts a lot of faith in the potential of young Afghans.
Out of the number of people we have so far been able to contact, there have been very, very positive and very good reactions. Because, you know, youth around the world, they're full of energy, they're full of hope, no matter how difficult their situation is. I mean, if nobody else is taking care of you, why don't you take care of your own future? Why don't you take your own future in your hands? For how long are we going to wait for people to make decisions for us?
Safi understands the limitations of organizing young people to solve the country's most deep-rooted problems, but he is undeterred.
post-war Afghanistan is going to be a very young Afghanistan. It is going to be the Afghanistan that will belong to the young generation. Now, we all understand what is the priority for the young generation of Afghanistan. It is education, and it is education that brings stability, that brings peace, and that puts an end to a conflict.
Awakened Youth of Afghanistan has a Facebook group, of which Safi is a member. While perusing the list of members, I realized that they were almost all men. I asked Safi if women were playing an active role in the youth movement.
Of course not. I mean, the young women are confined, they are restricted, and they are denied a lot of opportunities that men are not, okay? Now, that is what we're going to do. I mean, this is a step-by-step process. We've got to be very careful here. You see, we do not have a political support yet. We do not have a political backing yet. And we should not be very radical in trying to immediately modernize the concept.
Wajma Fo says that, though often limited by social standing, education, or simply location, many Afghan women have been leading peace initiatives for years.
Although you don't hear about it, it's not a very kind of fashionable news that would kind of attract attention. But in the past 9 years, women organizations, they have had initiatives for peace, they have had prayers for peace. Even like I have been part of a regional talks for peace with the Pakistani women on the other side of the region.
Fo says that Afghan women do not want the international community or the U.S. to come and save them. The issue for both young Afghans and Afghan women is that they lack the support of their government. But it seems that there is at least a small group ready to fight for their future.
There are these limitations that are prompting me to work more harder and more harder than if there were none of these challenges that we are facing at the moment. So I'm well aware of these challenges, and I can tell you that. I mean, it takes time, okay, but it is never late or too early to start. We are just in the right moment to start.
For War News Radio, I'm Karim Sari Ahmed.
This is War News Radio. When most people think about the life of a soldier stationed in Iraq or Afghanistan, the images that come to mind are those of high-tension patrols where gunfire and car bombs lie around every corner. It's likely that some scenes from The Hurt Locker pop up too. But in reality, a significant portion of their time is spent not out on missions, but entertaining themselves back at the base. Emily Crawford has the story, which first aired in July.
On April 23rd, 2010, a viral sensation in the making hit YouTube. Today, it has well over 5 million views. No, it's not a Lady Gaga music video. It's a remake of one, performed and filmed by a group of soldiers stationed in Afghanistan. Soldiers Aaron Melcher and Justin Baker are the masterminds behind the video, which parodies Lady Gaga and Beyoncé's video for the song Telephone. Baker says that the inspiration for the video came from an impromptu dance-off.
Me and the redhead guy from the video, Melcher, we were pulling an engine on a Humvee, and we were just trying to lighten the mood. Everybody was stressed out and stuff, so we just started jokingly dancing on, you know, against one another, and we decided it would probably make a funny video, and he said he had been wanting to do it since last deployment, so we started writing up everything we wanted to do and then just started making it and recruited all the guys that we could to be in it.
Melcher posted the video on YouTube so that close friends and family could see it. And what started as a small project quickly expanded to one of the most written about internet memes of the spring. It showed up on nearly every popular blog and even sparked a response video from NPR. Baker maintains that this attention came as a complete surprise.
It really was unexpected. We didn't really think it would be funny unless you knew us, because me and Melcher, we both have a kind of a personality where, you know, we're always joking around, always, you know, and so we didn't really think that people would get it, and it seems like some people didn't. Like, so it seems like some people just think that we're actually gay and thought that this video would be like, you know, like we thought it was going to actually be like, I don't know. I thought, based on some of the comments, though, some of the people didn't actually believe that we were in Afghanistan.
Despite the many anonymous homophobic or generally skeptical comments that the video received online, the overall message seems to have been a positive one. It shows a more lighthearted, good-humored side to American soldiers, and as Baker says, demonstrates that morale is still relatively high.
I read a lot of comments saying, it's good that soldiers can find something to do in their free time.
Despite the video's popularity, however, Baker still refuses to take any credit for the song choice.
I am not myself a Lady Gaga fan.
The video that Baker performed in is one of many, all created by troops stationed abroad who were in search of something to do to pass the time. After a long day of patrol, or even active combat, soldiers typically have 4 or 5 hours of free time to kill after dark. Much of this time is taken up by planning for the next day, training, or simply talking to loved ones. But soldiers often still have time left over to spend on projects of their own. Even in the early days of the war, when internet access was more limited, U.S. troops still found plenty of ways to entertain themselves. Major Leon Hooten, who served in Iraq in 2003, tells of the many creative projects his platoon took on.
We had a local carpenter build us a bar, and we couldn't drink alcohol, but we built ourselves like a cantina kind of thing that looked like a tiki bar. And we had another carpenter build us some pool tables and foosball. And we got some basketball court built in my company area. So we played basketball, or we did a lot of sports, and we watched movies. And that was I think that was most of it, really. Oh, and we built a stage, and some of us were musicians amateurly. So we got guitars, and so we'd put on little concerts and stuff.
The homemade bar that Hooten refers to became a kind of social center for his whole battalion.
It was probably 18 feet long or so, and we put it in our aircraft hangar, and then we bought this thatched roofing material and some plywood and stuff, and we built up this bar and tables and chairs and stools and stuff. And we got blenders, and we'd get near beer, and we had piped in satellite TV from satellite TV. And so basically it was all the same stuff as you'd normally do, just socializing and hanging around and having virgin drinks and near beer, which was kind of crappy, but, the best we could do. And it was really a one-of-a-kind place within the battalion area. We were the only company that had a bar, so it was called the Cold-Blooded Lounge because our call sign on the radio, we were the cold-blooded because we were medics. So, yeah, it ended up being a good place to hang out.
Projects like Major Hooten's Cold-Blooded Lounge or Baker's music video provide soldiers with creative outlets to relieve the tension of military service in a war, but they also serve simply as ways to pass the time. Captain Stuart DeBreer, a medic who also served in Iraq, mainly in Baghdad itself, describes what his everyday schedule is like.
Well, for me, most of the day would just consist of obviously going to work for about 12 hours, and then we would always have local Iraqis who would provide us with entertainment as far as movies and things like that. So, just keeping up on the latest things that are out in movie theaters is pretty much most of the day for me.
It seems that although the public perception of soldiers' lives is one of violence and drama, in reality, they seem to spend a lot of time doing, the same stuff that people do at home. In their own words.
We played a lot of sports.
I have a subscription to a couple of Mustang magazines.
Some level of video games, too, would always be involved.
I read all of Dan Brown's books.
And we watch movies.
We actually, we networked a couple of Xboxes together and had some projectors set up.
We had the Air Force challenge, so we went and played them in football.
Headed to the gym for a couple hours there.
We'd play soccer with the local kids and stuff.
Projects like the telephone video certainly seem to help the servicemen and women involved in them to relax, but they're also extremely entertaining for all of us back at home. For War News Radio, I'm Emily Crawford.
This is War News Radio. Ahmed Gailani, the first Guantanamo detainee to be tried in a civilian court, was recently acquitted of all but one charge against him. The case served as a first test of the Obama administration's plan to try detainees in federal court. Sam Hirschman talks with legal experts about the prospect of civilian trials for detainees. This piece first aired in June.
President Obama promised to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay throughout his campaign. He signed an executive order on his first day in office that said the government would close the prison within a year. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, guaranteed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other architects of 9/11 would be tried in federal court in New York City. He claimed it would be the trial of the century. So far, none of this has happened. And Jack Goldsmith, former head of the Office of Legal Counsel to the President under George W. Bush, says closing Guantanamo might not even make much of a difference.
Not much of substance will be achieved if Guantanamo is closed if the detainees are sent to the United States, because they receive the same legal rights on Guantanamo as they would in the United States.
Initially, because it wasn't on American soil, Guantanamo's legal ambiguities were used to justify holding detainees without charge or trial. Since then, several Supreme Court decisions have expanded the rights of detainees. A number of legal scholars, including Jack Goldsmith, believe that now Guantanamo doesn't offer any more legal leeway than a prison in the United States. For Jonathan Hafitz, a lawyer at the ACLU, the prison's legal gray areas undermine the fabric of American law.
The solution to Guantanamo is not simply closing the prison and moving the detainees to the United States and reopening Guantanamo North in Thompson, Illinois, where they've talked about a future U.S. Guantanamo or anywhere else in the country. The only way to close Guantanamo responsibly, consistent with the country's laws, constitution, and values, is to shut the prison and to release any detainee, either to their home country or in resettlement in a third country, other than those who are going to charge and prosecute in a federal court in accordance with the Constitution and laws of this country.
For 8 years, lawyers like Jonathan Hafitz have been arguing that Guantanamo violates international law and the U.S. Constitution. Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions says that prisoners of war may not be tortured and that they cannot be sentenced without a trial, among other protections. Though the Bush administration denied that Common Article 3 applied to Guantanamo detainees, the Supreme Court said in 2006 that it does. Hafitz believes that detention at Guantanamo has not met the Common Article 3 criteria.
Guantanamo is, from the perspective of international law, an abomination. It is the indefinite detention of individuals without charge, without trial, and now entering its eighth year.
But the conventions also say that prisoners of war can be held until the end of a conflict without charge or trial. The Supreme Court, Congress, and Presidents Bush and Obama have all said that because the U.S. is still technically engaged in an armed conflict, current practice at Guantanamo is legal.
We're allowed to detain them until the end of the conflict.
That's Jack Goldsmith again. If it's legal to detain prisoners at Guantanamo until the end of the war, that raises a new question. When are the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over? Or are they both part of one larger war on terror, as President Bush often said? And that's not the only tricky issue. When the war ends, the detainees must either be released or put on trial. The Bush administration wanted to try the Guantanamo detainees in specially conceived military tribunals, but creating a new trial system was full of problems. President Obama and his advisors have gone back and forth. Attorney General Holder has guaranteed a trial in civilian courts, but that might not happen. Jack Goldsmith thinks the trial should happen in federal courts.
For the people that we do plan to have trials for, I think, especially for the top detainees, I've written and I believe that the military commissions are not a good way to go, that they should be done in civilian trials, because the military commission has lots of legal problems that will have to be sorted out.
Regardless of how the trials proceed, if at all, the decision on how forcefully to move on Guantanamo lies with President Obama. Does he want to spend political capital to convince members of Congress the prison should be closed? How many prisoners should be released? Should the rest be tried, and how? In answering those questions, he will have to weigh what is legal, what is possible, and what is just. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman. This is War News Radio.
Nestled in the small downtown adjoining Swarthmore College is a restaurant serving food from various cuisines of the Middle East. The owner, Azim Nadarpour, grew up in Afghanistan in the 1980s and moved to the United States almost 20 years ago. In his time here, he has worked his way up in the eatery business and finally has a chance to run his own restaurant. Now, he has time to reflect on his journey. Nick Felt has the story in this piece, first aired in May.
Recently, there's been some talk on campus about a new restaurant in the small town of Swarthmore. Billed as Arya Mediterranean Cuisine, it sounded like it might be a refreshing new take on what can often be pretty lackluster college food, so I thought I'd stop by and see for myself. Walking up to the door, the first thing I noticed was the smell. A savory aroma of rich spices and grilling kebab wafting out of the restaurant and down the sidewalk. Inside, the owner, a busy but congenial man named Azim Nadarpour, told me about the menu.
We have a lot of type of kebabs in here, and also we have a lot of dishes, man. You know, I'm from Afghanistan, but I make Mexican food, Indian food, Greek food. I make everybody happy in Swarthmore.
Intrigued by Azim's mention of his home country, I wanted to find out more about his story and how he came from Afghanistan. It turned out that he grew up in Kabul during the Soviet invasion in the 80s. When the Soviets pulled out in 1989, Azim was only a teenager, but he knew that if he stayed, he might be pulled into the conflict.
Obviously, there's a lot of fighting, and it was a not safe place to live there. So when you are like 14 or 15 years old, and you have to join the army.
Though Azim has been away from his home country for about 2 decades, he still vividly remembers the day he left.
I came March 21st, 1990, and it's almost maybe 18 years ago or 17 years, I don't even remember.
Although he was still young, he decided to leave the country, and his parents gave him the okay.
When I leave my country, my mom, my dad, and my oldest brother, and they told me, it's your hand. If you can make it, go ahead.
But making the long trip would prove to be difficult.
I was 14 years old. Yeah, I walked from Afghanistan to Pakistan. It takes me at least 2 weeks. Wow. More than 2 weeks. God knows, we don't even count the day and the night. It just half by horse and half by walking. So we just made it to Pakistan.
Even after reaching the border, Azim had to get past the police. If caught, they would have sent him back to join the army. But with help from family friends, he made it safely into Pakistan, where he moved from city to city, working odd jobs. Eventually, he had enough saved up to buy tickets to fly to New York City, and he applied for a passport to come to the U.S.
You apply. You never know. One day they let you know, hey, listen, this is your passport, and you're ready to go.
After arriving in New York, Azim had a lot to adjust to, fending for himself while still just a teenager. He found lodging with his cousin, but even so, getting by was tough. For one thing, he had to learn to speak English.
Wow. When I came here, I went to high school for 1 year, and actually 2 years. And also watching TV, actually, that's yeah. The best one. And if I don't understand anything, I ask somebody, what does that mean, or explain it to me.
He finished high school, but couldn't take time off for college. The need to find a job was too pressing. Instead, he got his start in the restaurant business, working with his cousin.
Helping with the kitchen, you know, he was a big chef over there. Then I started working another job in the supermarket, doing the cashier. I worked so many places, like so many restaurants, but I end up with the Caspian Grill as my favorite spot to end up. It's a good place and nice people, and I learned all my cooking from over there.
It was there, working at the Caspian Grill in a suburb of Washington, D.C., that Azim really got his start as a chef, picking up recipes from his boss.
I worked for somebody almost like 15 years, and this guy is my master chef. I learned everything from this guy. He knows how to make Afghan food, Greek, Middle Eastern, Persian, you name it.
Curious, I asked Azim how he ended up in Swarthmore, an out-of-the-way destination. It turns out that 4 years ago, he began selling food at a farmer's market across the street from Arya's current location.
Every summer I'm doing a farmer's market outside the co-op. So I saw this place is empty, and I said, why not? Let's go for it.
But going forward with his plans for a restaurant wasn't easy. Azim says it took him over a year to get his business off the ground.
It's not easy to open a restaurant. It takes time. It takes time, and I was a very patient man. And finally it's over, so I just pass everything, you know, ready to open it.
Now, Aria's been open for almost half a year. Its menu is influenced by some of the same cuisines Azim became familiar with at the Caspian Grill, Indian, Greek, Mexican, but a particular specialty is food from Afghanistan.
We have a lot of main dishes in here, like from main dish from Afghanistan, we call them kebab, like shish kebab, lamb kebab, chicken kebab.
The restaurant has a special touch when it comes to showcasing the rich flavoring of its food. As Azim explains, smiling, he knows how to use the aromas from his kitchen to attract new customers.
I leave the door open, and especially the kebab. If we cook the kebab smells, bring people from outside. Oh, what are you cooking, man? It's kebab. Oh, okay. Hook me with some nice sandwich or a platter, or, you know. That's the way you gotta do it.
Running the restaurant has been a lot of work, and business is sometimes off and on. In his own words, Azim works 8 days a week. He dreams of being able to take a break from his job once his business is more established.
I need a good vacation, to be honest. It's been a long time. I'm working 17 years, and I'm working so hard.
If he could, he'd like to go back to Afghanistan to visit the country he hasn't seen in 2 decades.
I would love to go back home to see my country for like a month or so. And we have a lot of good friends over there, and not a lot of family actually, but a lot of friends. And in the future, maybe I can open one business in Afghanistan too. We never know, right?
For the time being, Azim is content with where he is, the proud owner of a new restaurant who's worked his way up from a rough start after leaving his home at the young age of 14. Describing his plans for the future, he says,
I want to open forever, to be honest with you. But if the people of Swarthmore, if they come here and eat, I can survive and pay my rent, I will never close. And so far, so good. They're coming.
Though life hasn't been easy, business at Aria is going well, and Azim's outlook is optimistic.
Basically, you know, so far, so good. I just do my best. Do some cooking, you know, make the SWAT more happy.
For War News Radio, I'm Nick Felt.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Sam Hirschman. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm Kyle Crawford. Until next time, thanks for listening.